So let's talk about how you ended up meeting Ogilvy. So your first letter to Ogilvy, the job you never took, how is it that you even came to think about writing a letter to him? Did you know you wanted to work with him at that time?
I'd been a fan of his since he wrote his first book. And I mentioned in our last talk about the job I got in this agency because Charlie thought she wanted more money than me. And that agency was full of very talented people. One of them was a guy called Peter Mayle, who wrote some very successful books that were made into films. Another was a guy called Alan Parker, who is now Lord Parker, who became a filmmaker, made some films that people would recognize. It was also a highly political agency, and I was in the middle of a war, and I was on the wrong side, and eventually the guy who ran it, an American, very funny man called Joe Sacco, took me out to lunch and said, "Have a drink, Drayton." And I said, "Okay." He said, "Have a proper drink." I said, "What do you mean a proper drink?" He said, "Have what I have." And he was drinking this mixture of Crane de Menthe and brandy. And he said, "Look," he said, "you're going to get fired." He said, "Because we've lost, you know, I've lost all this, that and the other." But I was very friendly with Peter Mayle, who'd worked for David Ogilvy.
In what capacity did he work for him?
Oh, he'd been a copywriter in New York. He said, "Hey, write to Ogilvy and I'll write you a little testimonial." And I wrote to David Ogilvy, and I was very careful to do exactly what I had learned I should do. Again, this is study coming into it. I'd read that Ogilvy liked people to send him 5 pieces of work. And so I wrote a letter, which I wish to God I'd kept, with 5 pieces of work. And I remember it began something along the lines of, "Dear Mr. Ogilvy, you've never heard of me, but I have a talent that I know you prize. I know how to make people buy things." And I sent quite a long letter, and I got a reply instantly inviting me to have an interview with his international VP, who was over in London.
Was it from him directly?
No, it was from him directly. I wrote to him directly. I got a reply directly. I've noticed that important people do reply directly. I correspond with Sir Martin Sorrell. Every time I send him an email, I get a reply.
How did Ogilvy reply? Through the mail or phone?
He wrote through the mail, because in those days it cost a bloody fortune to phone anyhow. And one thing that David was careful with was money. He's Scottish.
Were you surprised that he replied?
I was thrilled to bits. But I didn't go for the interview, and I didn't do that because at that time I was divorced from my first wife, but I had 3 young children, and I didn't want to go to America and leave them. And from a career point of view, I've no doubt I would have done better in America, but there you are.
How old were your kids at that time?
They would have been 7, 8, 9, something like that. Quite young.
Were you divorced at that time?
Oh, yeah. Their mother was looking after them, and she was in Manchester. No, she's in London at that time, and then eventually she went to Manchester, but I used to see them fairly regularly. Then one day I was in a pub, where else, in Knightsbridge in London, talking to a young man whom I'd actually been an advisor to, because one of the things I did during my years out in the cold was I would act as a sort of temporary creative man for agencies, and I would solve problems for them. And I got quite well paid for it. But I got to know 1 or 2 people who were fascinated by the fact that I knew the mail order business. And this guy was one of them, and he started doing quite well, working in direct marketing. And we were having a drink, and he said, "You know more about this direct marketing business than anyone I've ever met. You should start an agency." And I had another friend who had just come back from working, I think, in France. He'd also worked in Africa and Malaysia, and he was looking around for what to do. And we got together in a wine bar off Bond Street and got extremely drunk on champagne. And I remember one of them said, "Let's have a partnership, you know, one third, one third, one third." Now, I'd already had the experience of being in a partnership of one third and one third and one third. I didn't say anything at the time, but when the youngest of the three left, I turned to the man who'd suggested it, and his name was Glenmore, and I said, "Glenmore, that is probably the most expensive single mistake you will ever make in your life." And he said, "Why?" And I said, "Because I think that John would have been very happy to accept a minority share because he was younger than both of us." But we went into this agency and we had absolutely nothing. I was in debt to the Inland Revenue, living under a false name. John, I can remember, had 1 jacket with a rip in the back, 1 pair of jeans, and he drove around in a clapped-out car which only had 1 seat in the front. And Glenmore also was very short of money. I had money, but I owed a lot of money. And once again, I put up all the money I had to start the company. I think, again, I had about £700. And we used to work first thing in the morning, late at night, over lunch. lunchtime and carry on with the jobs we had.
You three started this agency, and was this specifically a direct marketing agency?
Well, we actually applied direct marketing. We did a test. I wrote two letters. One was to sell the idea of people who might want direct marketing work, and the other one was to sell to people who might want some international advertising, because both Glenmore and I, this is Glenmore Trinity Harvey, the other partner, and I had both worked in the international field.
So this was your plan on getting clients, using actual direct mail to do it?
We used direct mail, and what happened was, I think we sent out 50 letters, we got 12 replies, and Glenmore followed up on the phone, and we got 3 jobs, I think. And one of the people who replied and said, "We're not really interested, don't call us, we'll call you," was the Reader's Digest Association. But we got enough interest to start the business. What I did, which I think, looking back, was a smart thing I did, which I don't think many people do. This was something new, and people were making money out of it, but nobody was really proselytizing. Nobody was really promoting the idea of direct marketing itself. And so we started vigorously doing so. We started doing house advertisements, and you may have noticed that advertising agencies never advertise. They don't believe in it. But we started running advertisements. And then I started writing articles for the first magazine on the subject, which was called Direct Response Magazine. And then we had the idea of running conferences. And again, I wrote a letter to sell these events, one-day events, up and down the country, selling the idea of direct marketing.
What year was this?
This was 1977.
So you were selling the idea of direct marketing to businesses?
We were selling the idea of direct marketing. My idea was, the first person who sells the concept, if nobody else is selling it, owns the concept. If you go back to the early days of the advertising business, there's a new book out about Albert Lasker, who made more money out of advertising than anyone before or since. The reason Lasker had done so well was that they sold the concept of advertising as salesmanship in print. And I'd studied all this, and I thought, wow, you know, if nobody else is really selling the concept of direct marketing, we must sell the concept of direct marketing. And the other thing I was determined to do was to be everywhere. So anybody wanted any comment on direct marketing, I would make it. At one point, I used to look through all the marketing magazines, and if I wasn't in them every week, I was bloody furious. We would go to every event, but only on the condition that we thought we could get enough business to pay for the cost of attending the event. And we had a rule. At that time, we needed £1,000 a week to live. And I used to say to Glenmore, who is a very good salesman, "We need £1,000 a week. That's all I want you to think about." And every Wednesday, I would say to him, I still joke about it because we're still friends, I would say to him, "Glenmore, where the fuck is the grand?"
You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. How would you guys charge when you got a client? I mean, how did you end up making money with them?
We would charge fees because, of course, with direct marketing, much of which was direct mail, some of it was advertising, there was no commission basis as there was with advertising. So as a way of making money, the direct marketing agency was not a very good model compared to the advertising model that I was talking to you about in my last talk with you, where you had this commission basis. So you had to charge fees. And charging fees was quite a difficult job. But again, the other principle we had, we charged more than anyone else. And I can remember we had offices eventually in Covent Garden. And I can remember a man coming in to see me. And I quoted a price to him. And he said, "That's very expensive." And I said, "You know something? I can save you a lot of trouble." I said, "I can point you in the direction of about 8 other agencies within 5 minutes walk of here, all of whom will charge less than us." But, you know, if everyone knows if it's cheap, it's no good. I remember the first significant client we ever got. Because we had no money, we used to have to rent an office by the hour. And we had this client come in from a big mail order company. And we said, "If we get the business, we'll buy them lunch." And we got the business, but they were paying £250 for a mailing package. And we said, "We want £500. And they said, "Oh, we don't pay that." And we said, "Okay, how about £500 if it works?" So they said, "Oh, all right, you're on." So then we had to take them to lunch. We took them to a pub around the corner called the Crown and Two Chairmen. We couldn't pay for the lunch. We had no money. My secretary had to persuade the landlord to give us sandwiches and beer on account. After we got the business, which became our first big client, the client said to me, "We knew very well it wasn't your office, you know, because we were pretending it was our office." So we were really, really short of money. We had absolutely nothing. But what we did was, the first thing that happened was that I found somebody who needed some creative services in Carnaby Street in London, a street full of fashion. And we did a deal with them where we didn't pay rent. We paid for the rent by way of giving them creative services. And then eventually we had to pay them rent, but we never did because they went broke. But before they went broke, somebody had approached my partner, Glenmore, and asked him if he'd like to be managing director of quite a big agency. Glenmore came back and said, you know, they've asked me to be managing director. I don't know why I said this. I must have been crazy in those days. I said, why don't you go back to him? His name was Bob something or other. Go back to him and tell him we'll buy the agency. I'd done a bit of research, and we'd found out that this agency was actually part-owned by a big American agency called Warwick & Legler. The reason for this was that Warwick & Legler had accounts in the UK that they wanted handled, and we knew that this agency was in trouble. They'd had a big account, and they'd lost it, so they were really losing money. They were just being kept afloat. So what I did was I had lunch with my partners and the guys from New York, the Warwick & Legler guys, and said, listen, we'll run the agency for you, because the guy who was running it wanted to retire, he'd made his money, he wanted to get out. Well, the getting out was good. I said, we'll run the agency for you, and we'll take it over.
Did you meet with him in the UK?
Yeah, at dinner in the UK.
How many accounts did he have at that time?
Not very many, about four or five. I think they were crazy. I mean, I've seen a lot of this. I've seen a lot of American companies come over here thinking it's an easy market, which it really isn't.
Were these just traditional advertising accounts?
They were traditional advertising accounts. Because I'd been brought up in traditional advertising, I didn't care what people wanted me to do. You want a commercial, I'll do a commercial. You want some direct mail, I'll do some direct mail. You want an advertisement that you'll get replies, I'll do that. I'll do anything, you know.
Would your agency handle all the media buying and everything for your client?
We couldn't for a while because we didn't have sufficient financial status to do so. And eventually, we did a very complicated deal where we borrowed money in order to put on an account to show that we had the status to be able to place advertising. And so at that point, we started making money. And at the same time, we weren't paying anything for our offices again. We were sitting in these smart offices in Soho in London, which really belonged to this other agency. It was this hilarious experience because the first thing we did was we came in and I got rid of a lot of people because the agency was overstaffed. And we ran it for quite a while, the better part of a year. And then just before the year came to an end, the people from America contacted us and said, look, we don't want to do the deal with you anymore because we found some people to buy the agency. And I was furious because we put in a lot of work. And what happened was that these people were coming in the next day on the Saturday. And on the Friday, I wrote a memorandum to all the staff. And the thing is, this agency had had a lot of vicissitudes and changes. And I remember the memo began with the words, I think you will agree that Graham & Gillis, which was the name of the agency, Graham & Gillis may not have been well run, but this has been frequently run. And now I have news of another change for you. And these three guys were coming in, and I met them the next day, and I had a chat with them. And I said, could you tell me something? Have you, by any chance, mortgaged your houses in order to do this deal? And they said, yes. And I just knew they'd done this, you know, because advertising people are, as a rule, not good business people.
Were these American guys or UK guys?
No, they were UK guys, but quite senior guys. One of the head of account handling at Young & Rubicam, which is a big agency. And then I said to them, and tell me something, have you actually seen the accounts of the agency of Graham & Gillis? And they said, no. And I said, well, you're in for a very, very interesting ride. They lost all their money.
They had already made the investment, came in, and then they lost their money?
They're idiots. The one thing that strikes me about business is that I may think I'm stupid, but my God, I've met a few people that are even more stupid than I am.
Who had sold them the agency?
This guy, Bob. Boy, he was a smart guy. His name was Bob Carpenter. He sold them a bill of goods. Yeah, absolutely. They were seduced by the brand name.
Yeah, so what happened?
What happened was that we moved out, and of course we'd been looking around because we didn't particularly like these offices anyhow. We thought they were too expensive. There was an area of London that was coming up called Covent Garden, and you could get cheap offices there. And so we moved into Covent Garden, and I think there were eight of us, and we had room for 50-odd people.
Did you take some of the people from the agency that went down that you were working with?
Absolutely not. There was only one guy there. We couldn't afford him. He was a brilliant media guy, a very, very clever man, but the rest of them were a waste of space.
Who were the eight people?
They were people that we'd recruited ourselves from when we began. Of course, by this time we were beginning to be significant. It took us 3.5 years to get from nothing to being the biggest agency around.
Now, when you say the biggest, how are you measuring the biggest?
In terms of the amount of business.
Dollar-wise?
Yeah, money.
During these 3 years, were you still out selling the idea of direct marketing through speaking and writing and stuff like that?
That's a very interesting question, because one of the things that made a big difference was these events. First of all, we made money out of selling the
event. What was an event?
We actually did a thing called the Printed Shop, and it was a whole day, and in which we, most of the day, analyzed in great detail the process of direct marketing and how it related to retailing, and people loved it, and we got business. Actually, Yes, the funny thing about these events was that I wrote this mailing, which again I wish I'd kept, which won an award for being the best mailing of the year. So I won an award, we made £10,000 and we got some business. And I hadn't wanted to do any public speaking. I was actually invited to do it and I was terrified because the only time I'd ever spoken in public I'd made a complete fool of myself.
Tell me about it. What happened?
Well, what happened was that when we started this business, I turned to my two partners who were younger than me, and I said, look here, I said, this is probably a wonderful adventure for you, but for me, this is the real thing. I'm 40 years old, and if I don't bloody well make it now, I never will. So I'm prepared to walk up and down Bond Street strangling people to make it work. Some while later, somebody rang up and said, will you come and do a talk to 120 publishers about their mailings? And I said, I'll get back to you. And I just said to my partners, look, I said, I just can't do this. I've only spoken once before. I was terrified. I made a complete fool of myself. And they said, look, you were the one who was going to walk up and down Bond Street strangling people.
Yeah.
So you better do it. But in order to do it, I had to have either one or two large brandies and two tranquilizers. And I remembered absolutely nothing about what I said. But I said to somebody afterwards, was it any good? They said, yes. And I said, why? And they said, because you knew what you were talking about. And it's interesting, one of the things I certainly have discovered about public speaking is that knowing what you're talking about is a damn sight more important than anything else. So that's how I started public speaking. But you were saying, did we carry on promoting? Boy, did we carry on promoting. I would say that for a period of 15 years, I was churning out about 6 articles or pieces for various publications every month. And I still do. And now a lot of them are blogs, but I still turn out a hell of a lot.
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. Do you have any of your old stuff or no?
Yes, I have. It's fascinating because one of my partners here found these things that were lying around in my office and said, hey, this is terrific. What is it? And I said, oh, that's something I used to send out to my creative director that Ogilvy made 20 years ago. And he said, it's marvelous. We must reprint it. Because I used to send this thing out to 50-odd offices at Ogilvy, and I couldn't get around to all of them. So I started writing this thing called Common Sense Creative. But, of course, very soon somebody called them bird droppings. But years later, I was speaking at a big event in Melbourne in Australia, and a guy came up to me who'd worked for me. He said, I've still got all your letters, you know. And I got a letter 18 months ago from a girl in Bangladesh. She said, I've got all these things, you know. I've still got them.
Since we're talking about for over those years you were still promoting, you said the start of your public speaking. Is that time you had started your public speaking? That was the reason why? And the writing of the book?
I was forced to do it, and once I'd learnt I could do it, I started doing it a little bit better, and I was terrified. I still am terrified. As a matter of fact, I don't think you're any good if you're not a bit frightened, you know?
Right.
What happened was that John Watson said to me, you know, why don't you write a book? You know, nobody's written a decent book. Well, John Watson was this young copywriter I'd met when I was a consultant to this agency in the 70s, and he was the one who actually suggested going into direct marketing, and eventually we split up, and we split up. Because, once again, there was a three-way partnership, and throughout the period of the whole thing, people were at each other's throats. In particular, John and Glenmore, who'd never met each other before, were at each other's throats. And there was this wonderful thing that I always remember. We were going to do a presentation to Chrysler in Knightsbridge again, and we were downstairs, and John said something so rude about Glenmore, I can't repeat it. He said, Glenmore is a complete blank, 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 blank. I've had enough of this. I'm leaving. And I remember sitting to him and saying, John, will you do me a favor and leave after the bloody presentation? They were always fighting with each other.
Okay, so you have this presentation with Chrysler. What did John do? What was your responsibility and what was the other guy's?
Again, the structure of a business is very important. So the thing that was wrong with the structure of this business, to be honest, was that both John and I were copywriters. John was a brilliant copywriter. We were very competitive. So we duplicated each other's efforts. And in the end, he left. What happened was that he wanted to hire a girl that he'd met. And I said, it's not a good idea to hire people you know or family members or this, that and the other. It gets very political. And he said, well, if you don't let me hire her, I'm leaving. And, of course, he was very talented. So we said, oh, all right then. And in no time at all, he was sort of vanishing into dark corners, so to speak. We'd see, we'd go off with her and we wouldn't know exactly where they were. And eventually, one day, I called him in and said, I'd like to have a chat with you. We called him into our little boardroom in Covent Garden and said, what are you up to? You're up to something. And he said, I'm not up to anything. I said, you are. And we had this very extraordinary standoff situation where I thought, well, you're not bloody well leaving this room until you tell us what you're up to. And eventually he admitted he was up to something, and he got someone else to finance him. In fact, when he was leaving, he actually came up to me and he said, look, he said, I've got no argument with you. He said, why don't you come with us? Well, he then went away and he built what became the largest direct marketing agency in Europe.
Really? What was that called?
It was called Watson Ward, Albert and Vandel. He was very, very fortunate because he went for growth. I went for profit. He would always say, this could be bigger, this could be bigger. And I would say, look, this could be more profitable. And going for growth is a sort of an interesting strategy if you've got the nerve. But I didn't have the nerve. And I can remember when I was running the Ogilvy direct business in London, that business was up for sale and it was losing money. But it was big. Not as big as we were, but it was big. And eventually, he managed somehow to sell it to some Italians who must have been mad. He did some pretty good deals, and then they sold it to one of the big advertising groups, Omnicom Group. Then his agency really was running Europe. And then he retired, and then he left, and then he started up again. He's actually got offices around the corner from me now.
Did he make millions in the business?
I think he did make millions. I don't know how much he made. I really don't know how much he made. He was fortunate in that he had a very shrewd advisor, very, very smart man who advised him.
Did you wish you had gone with him?
No. He took it very seriously. I mean, I do take it seriously, but he was very solemn about it. You've got to have a sense of proportion. But we duplicated each other.
Let's do about writing the book. Tell me, why were you writing a book?
Because I was looking at everything that had been written about direct marketing, including everything I'd seen in America. And I nowhere could I see something as simple, described it as simply as John E. Kennedy did when he said advertising is salesmanship in print. In 1981, I went away and I wrote the whole damn thing in 6 weeks. It was called Common Sense Direct Marketing. The title's changed, but it's still in print today, and it's out in 18 languages or 17 languages. There's a thing called the Institute of Direct Marketing here, and they told me that every year it's been the bestseller.
It's done over 200,000 copies?
Oh, yeah, probably more. And eventually I was approached by one of the two leading business publishers in this country, a firm called Kogan Page. Philip Kogan rang me up and said, oh, we'd like to publish the book. So I said, all right, then. We published it ourselves to start with, which reminds me of the old joke about, you know, the tailor is always the worst dressed man in the room. I was very good at selling other people's books, but absolutely bloody useless at selling mine.
So what kind of deal did you negotiate with them as far as royalty? Did they give you money up front?
No money up front, 10%.
So 10% of their wholesales?
Of the retail.
And you still getting royalties on that?
Oh, yeah, I do still get royalties. One of the things I have done is I never, ever gave away the copyright. Every year they would say, could you sign this form? And every year I would ignore it.
The publisher wanted the copyright?
Oh, of course, yeah. But the first book I wrote was a novel, which I wrote when I was in my 20s, which got very well reviewed, but didn't sell that well. It got into paperback, but no big deal. And the reason it didn't sell as well as it should was well put by my partner, who read it and said, it's extremely well written. She said, but I'm waiting for something to happen. There was no real plot. And I think the reason why the Common Sense Direct Marketing book did well is that it is a very easy read, and people have written to me and said, you know, it's like a novel. I want to know what's going to happen next. And it's really ridiculous, because when I wrote a novel, nobody wants to know what was going to happen next, because nothing did.
What made the book so good? Why was it so unique?
Because it was extremely simple. My model was David Ogilvy's book, Confessions of an Advertising Man. I thought, I'm going to make it interesting. So I made it personal. I talked about the fact that I started out with nothing, and I talked about the way I discovered direct marketing, and then I tried to say, this is why it's a good idea, because you can measure everything rather than guessing. And I gave examples of all the different kinds of industries and services that could use direct marketing and why. Then I described how it operates. This is what people want to know. This is, you do this, you do that. So I made it extremely simple. And I gave lots and lots of examples. And I covered lots of the questions that people asked, like, what is positioning? What do you mean when you talk about a brand? How do I get a good deal from the media? How do I choose a mailing list? What makes good creative work? What makes bad creative work? How should you deal with a client? How should a client deal with you? Everything. I went to interview a client because, as you know, I also do interviews, not as well as you, but I went to interview a client who had said to somebody that he'd built his business on my book, and he was doing about £20 million a year. He said, I'll tell you what, he said, the book I bought from you years ago, he said, is better than the one you've got now, which is just the same book, but much bigger, because, of course, the industry's got much more complicated with the internet and so on, databases and so on.
Set the stage with your first conversation with Ogilvy, what you were doing at that time. I want to know how you got involved with Ogilvy?
What happened was that writing obviously helped promote the agency, and we were really doing very well. And we'd been approached by 8 of the top 20 advertising agencies because they're all thinking, hey, we better get into this direct marketing stuff, you know, it's growing.
But when they approached you, what did they want?
They wanted to buy us.
Did offers come in?
Yeah. We would say, no, I'm not really interested. And we had preliminary conversations. But one day, somebody wrote a very insulting article in one of the advertising magazines, with the only be a real advertising magazine, which is called Campaign, about David Ogilvy. I then wrote a vigorous defense and said this man wasn't fit to kiss Ogilvy's arse. And the next thing that happened was the phone rang in my office, which was open plan, picked it up, and the voice at the other end said, hello, this is David Ogilvy. And I put my hand over the phone and I said to everyone, hey, David Ogilvy's on the phone. I was as pleased as punch. My hero was ringing me up. He said, I just wanted to thank you for that very kind letter you wrote. I said, not at all, blah, blah, blah. And he said, by the way, is Glenmore still with you? And I said, no. I said, he's a consultant because I'd got rid of Glenmore. This is another story, because he was a big spender. And he said, oh, he said, he's a consultant. He said, isn't that a euphemism for being unemployed? I probably agreed. Well, the next day, I had another call, and it was from a man called Peter Warren. He said, I'm Peter Warren, and I knew who he was. He was the highest paid man in British advertising, the chairman of the Ogilvy & Mather Group.
You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Sinoff's hardtofindseminars.com.
So I like the idea. And the one thing, I made one mistake. I thought, wow, you know, they've got big accounts. We'll be able to start doing direct marketing for all these big accounts. That didn't happen at all. The only account we got landed with was American Express, which was their biggest account. And it was horrifying when we actually took the agency over. The first thing that was funny was that there was somebody sitting there that I'd fired previously from our own agency. I said, good God, I'm going to have to fire him again. The second thing was, their clients wanted their money back. American Express, for instance, wanted money back. And I rang up Peter Warren and I said, look here, Peter, I know the basis of this business is mail order, you know, you pull satisfaction or your money back. I said, but some of your bloody clients want their money back. This is ridiculous. This is a terrible deal. And he said to me, oh, let's go and have dinner and we'll talk about it. And he was such a charming man, but he was also an exceptionally accomplished drinker. He could drink anyone under the table. Very difficult to negotiate with, but he said, so what do you want me to do? And I said, well, we've got a 3-year deal, make it a 5-year deal. And we just sat there over dinner and changed the deal, and very satisfying too it was for me in the end.
All right, so what was the deal you made? You got rid of the other guys because you didn't like them, and you accepted a deal to run the Ogilvy direct marketing agency for 5 years?
The 5 years was just the period during which I got paid. Well, I gave away about 40% of the money to my staff.
Did you get a salary?
Oh, yeah. What really happened was that David Ogilvy came over to meet all our clients, and I got on very well with him. And I also got on very well with the man who was running the business, a guy called Bill Phillips. And someone stole a wonderful picture, which is hilarious, of me gazing at David when he came to talk to all our staff. I looked like a star-struck moon calf gazing up at him. God, he was brilliant with clients because, you know, I was talking about you do your research. He did his research. So one of our accounts was the British Philatelic Board who sold stamps to people. And his first remark to the man, our client, was, tell me, what happened to George V's stamp collection? So he'd done his research. He knew that George V was very fond of collecting stamps. I mean, that's the kind of man he was. There are many other interesting things about him.
Did he dress impeccably all the time?
David, no. He used to wear old, well-made clothes. His only distinguishing mark was he always had these red braces. He was known as Old Red Braces.
What do you mean, red braces?
Like suspenders, you would say in America.
Oh, I see. Was he a drinker?
Not particularly.
Was he married with a family? Was he a family?
No, I still talked to his widow, Bertha. We just got on extremely well. After this thing, I went to a meeting in Amsterdam, and I was late, and I'd had some aftershave on, and I'd been running. I'd gone to the wrong office and this and that and the other, so I was sort of all of a flutter. And I got into this office, and David was sitting on a settee while they were having a meeting inside. And he said, come here. He said, come and sit next to me. So I went and sat next to him, and he said, my God, he said, is that you? Do I smell some aftershave? He said, you smell like a whore's boudoir.
Yeah.
So I said, how can you tell? How do you know? And immediately we had this relationship where we had lots of jokes. And then he said, how much did you get for the agency? And I said, I've no bloody idea. I said, it's taking me forever to pay for it. And then we went into this meeting and I saw him, wow, you know, well, he didn't approve of somebody, they knew it. So there was this meeting where all these people were doing presentations.
What were they presenting?
What they were supposed to do was to say, this is our office, this is is what we've done this year, blah, blah, blah. It was like all the heads of country. And this man from Switzerland stood up and started talking. This is a terrible presentation. This is our office building, blah, blah, blah. And then after a while, David said in a very loud voice, I can't stand another minute of this. I'm leaving.
Were these Ogilvy-owned agencies?
Yeah, they're all the Ogilvy-owned agencies.
Oh, and they're presenting, like, what's been going on with their offices.
Yeah, this is what's going on. But as I got to know him, the things that he did just made me laugh. I mean, I didn't realize that he liked me, but he did like me. And I realized this when what happened was that the guy in New York rang me up and said, could you persuade David to do a video for South Africa? Because he refuses to go there because he's got very strong views about race. So I said, why would he do it for me? And my partner in New York said, well, he loves you, you know. I said, but he said, oh, you see, he thinks the world of you. He said, you ring him up, he'll do it. So I rang him up and said, will you come and do a video? I said, I'll buy you lunch. We went to this video studio, and all the time, David was bumming cigarettes off the cameraman. He was always stealing other people's cigarettes and cigars and God knows what. But before he started, he took his jacket off to reveal these red suspenders. And he had no tie on, I don't think. And he said to me, he said, you know why I do that? He said, when he took his jacket off. And I said, no, David. He said, so they won't think I'm an old fart. So at the end, he said, all right. He said, I'll tell you what. He said, I'll buy you lunch. So I said, all right. So we went to this restaurant. When the bill came, he said, oh, let's go up and eat American Express. Do you take American Express? And the waiter said, no, monsieur. And David looks at me in a state of panic and says, God, he said, we're going to have to pay cash. Then he said, oh, it's 47 francs or whatever it was, you know. And I said, it's not 47, David, it's 147. You're living in the past. And he said, I preferred it then. He said, by the way, have you got any cash? I had to pay for my own lunch.
That's funny.
We went back to the office and I said, thanks very much for lunch. But then he invited us to stay in his chateau.
And who's us? Your whole staff or just yourself or what?
Oh, this was my wife, myself, and off we went. He's got this marvelous chateau where she still lives.
Had you remarried at that time after the 7-year deal?
I was on my third marriage by this time.
Okay, so this is your third wife.
Yeah, whom actually Doug Ogilvy likes a lot. But we drove to the chateau. I don't drive, but she had a Lotus Esprit Turbo, a very flashy car. We'd been at Cannes. I think I was doing a speech in Cannes. We drove up to the chateau and we arrived there. David came out and he said, what is this? And my wife said, this is a Lotus. He said, wonderful. He said, can I go for a drive in it? And she said, well, you can't drive it, but you can go for a drive. And the next day, he went for a drive in the local village. And suddenly David said to her, how do you wind the window down? Press that button and down the window. And he waved at somebody in a rather like the king, you know, waving his hand on it.
Yeah.
Very lordly fashion.
Yeah.
And he turned to my wife and he said, that's the local mayor. He hates me. He was such a character.
He was a good guy.
Well, he was a good guy if he liked you. If he didn't like you, he wasn't very nice at all. But he was very cunning. I mean, the first real business connection I had with him after I'd sold the business, the advertising agency in London rang me up and said, would you be willing to look at this piece of copy that we're about to run for the Save the Children Fund? And could you comment on it? And I said, yeah. And so I looked at the copy and I wrote a little report. And I said, this advertisement is lacking. Seriously, David Ogilvy talks about advertisements which are headless wonders. That's advertisements without headlines. I said, this is a tailless wonder. There is no request for action at the end. And I sent it off to them. And then the next day, the phone rang and David rang and he said, hello. He said, I'm very interested in the comments you made about that advertisement which I wrote. And he said, you're quite right. I'll rewrite it. Oh, God, we had so many funny conversations. Of course, he was a complete workaholic. He rang me up one day, 10:30 in the morning, he rang me up and said, David here. I said, yes, I now recognise your voice. He said, look, he said, what's wrong with Ogilvy and Mather? And I said, it's funny you should ask me that. That's a subject I've been thinking about. And he said, why don't you write me a report about it? So I said, I will. And he said, by the way, Merry Christmas. It was 10:30 on Christmas morning. And the funny thing was that I had already been asked, this is after the business had been bought by Martin Sorrell. And I was writing something for Martin Sorrell, so I was able to combine the two. Also, he was the most insecure man I've ever met.
Tell me why.
Two examples, one which was one of the greatest moments in my life. But we were at a thing in London, and he was about to make a speech to all the assembled bigwigs from the Ogilvy Group and all the agencies that they owned. And we were at a table with David and his wife and two people from an agency they owned, a man and his wife. And David was fiddling and not eating and this, that and the other. And I could tell he was very nervous. I said, look, David, I said, everybody loves you. They all think you're marvellous. Don't worry, you know. And he said, shut up. He was really, really, really nervous. So the other thing that I never forget was that he rang me up one day and he said, I'm very worried about money. He was always worried about money. And he said, would you be willing to do some seminars with me? And I've never been so flustered in my life. And I said, you don't need to bloody well get me involved, David. I said, I can always find lots of people who'd be delighted to hear you say anything beyond good morning. They'll be very happy to pay. But he was very, very insecure.
Did you do seminars with him?
No, I never did. I had, again, a very flattering moment. I was doing a speech to the heads of office in Barcelona, and he was there, and I'd never spoken in front of him, and I was absolutely terrified. I didn't sleep a wink that night, and I got down to do my talk, and he wasn't there. And I was so disappointed, and I thought, oh, God, you know, I didn't sleep for nothing, bloody hell. And I stood up and started speaking, and then he came in. And afterwards, somebody told me what had happened. He had been being interviewed by a journalist, and the journalist said to him, tell me, Mr. Ogilvy, what's the worst interview you've ever had? And David said, this one. And the journalist said, why? And he said, because I've got a friend next door who's about to make a speech, and I'd rather listen to him than talk to you. Good morning. He rang me up one day, and he said, why do you go around the world giving away all our secrets? Because I was, you know, running around making speeches like mad. I said, David, I said, for 40 years you've been telling people exactly what to do in considerable detail. I said, they can't do it because there's a poem by Rudyard Kipling, the last line of which talks about they copied this, they copied that, they copied the other, but they cannot copy my mind. I said, nobody can copy your mind. You and I know we can talk till we're blue in the face and people still don't know how to do it. But after that he used to ring me up and make fun of it. He rang me up one day and he said, morning, he said, David here. I said, yes, David. He said, just back from making another speech, eh? He was funny. The second time I was staying with him, his wife had to go to Paris with the children, and she said, I'm going away now, so is there anything you'd particularly like me to get the cook to prepare while I'm away? I said, well, when we were driving through, we saw a hare, which you don't see very often. It'd be lovely to have some jugged hare. And Herta said, well, it's impossible to get a jugged hare, but we could do rabbit, lapin à la moutarde. And David said, I hate rabbit. When we were poor, when I was young, we had rabbit all the time.
Yeah.
Rabbit will never be served in this house. So the next day, when Herta had gone, they served rabbit. And David looked at me and said, this is your doing.
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. What does rabbit taste like?
A bit like chicken. Well, during the war, chicken was very expensive during the Second World War, and they used to serve rabbit disguised as chicken. And I can remember my mother, who was a very fine cook, and my parents had a very good restaurant in their pub, won a bet with somebody when she went to a restaurant and said, this is rabbit, not chicken.
Well, so if you were to sum it up, what was remarkable about him?
I asked two people who knew him very well, both of whom I still talk to. One is Joel Rafelson, who co-wrote a book with the other one, whose name is Ken Roman. Ken's the chairman of the Ogilvy Group. In fact, I've got to do an interview with him. You just reminded me. And they've written a book called Writing That Works. And I've seen Joel quite a few times. And one time I was in Chicago for some reason, and I had lunch with Joel, and I said, what do you think made David so remarkable? And he said, he was an incredible worker. He said, I'm a hard worker. He said, and I would go into the office on a Saturday to do some work, and David would be there. And I would drive past on Sunday evening, and the light would still be on there, and he'd still be working away. He was a very, very hard worker. I asked Ken Roman over breakfast in New York once, what do you think made David so remarkable? And Ken said to me, he said, look, he said, I've done pretty well. You know, he was the chairman of the group. And he said, I think the reason I've done pretty well is that I don't give up. If it doesn't work first time, I'll try again. If it doesn't work, and I'll keep going for a couple of years, you know. I just won't give up. He said, but David never gives up. 20 years, 30 years, he never gives up. One person I don't know, or didn't know very well, is no longer with us. It was the man who succeeded David as the chairman of the Ogilvy Group, Jock Elliott. But I was having lunch with a friend of mine who was actually a director of J. Walter Thompson, and I was talking to him about David, and he said, oh, he said, Jock Elliott told me that the thing that was remarkable about David was that not that he was a great copywriter, not this, not that. He knew precisely and in some considerable detail exactly what kind of business he wanted to have before he had it. He was a multifaceted individual.
How did you end up getting on the Ogilvy board, and what did that mean?
Well, he went to board meetings in exotic spots, and that's what you were supposed to help run the business. What happened was that after I'd been there for quite a short time, Bill Phillips was replaced by Ken Roman, and Ken Roman, for whatever reason, rang me up and said, look, I'd like you to take on a wider role and I'd like you to be the worldwide creative director of Ogilvy & Mabe. And actually, this is a lie. They asked me to come to New York and talk to him, and I went to New York and had breakfast with him at the Hyatt. And he said to me, what do you think you could do for Ogilvy & Mabe? Which is a very interesting question. Clever question. I said, I don't know, I'll think about it. And I went away and I wrote him a memo and I said, look, number one, I think that you have all these offices around the world and some are good, some are not so good, but there is no coherent central policy and I think that I could instill a sense of common purpose to people. And the other thing I think I can do, because I've been doing it for quite a long time, is I think I could help people raise their creative standards. Because the thing that gets people excited is, you know, the thing that they see or the thing they hear or the thing they look at. And so he then rang me up in London and he said, I'd like you to be the worldwide creative director and vice chairman. He said, but there's one other job I'd like you to do. And I said, what's that? And he said, I'd like you to handle the American Express business. So I said, oh, all right.
Was that good news to you?
Well, it was good news and bad news. It was good news because it was their premier account. It was bad news because it was a very tricky piece of business. But as it happens, I was fortunate. The people at American Express never noticed how useless I was. I've still got some very good friends from American Express. But in fact, in the end, they hired me to do a training program for their senior marketing people.
So you accepted the worldwide creative position?
Oh, yeah, I did all that. So I used to whiz around like a maniac. In fact, it's really funny. I was talking earlier on today with the present chief executive of Ogilvy One, which is the name for what was Ogilvy & Mabe, the director. He's now the global head of Ogilvy One. And I used to go and visit him in Toronto when he ran Toronto. He's running around, and I said, you remind me of me. I said, you were running around like a maniac.
Did more money come with that?
Now, that's a very good question. I think I'm a very bad negotiator, but this is one of the rare occasions when I was a good negotiator, because I thought, what the hell should I ask them for in terms of money? I have no idea. And I thought about it for a bit, and then eventually I rang up 10, and I said, how much would you normally pay somebody running half of a business turning over whatever, however many million it was? And that way, I got a very big salary. In those days, a lot of money. The first year, I managed to pull in a sum not unadjacent to $500,000.
How many years were you handling that?
I was only doing it for about 5 years, I would think, maybe. I was only with them for about 8 years, because what happened was that when I got on the board, so the most interesting thing about the board, the two interesting things, the 23 people on the board, which I thought was ridiculous. I don't think you could do anything with 23 people. I think a lot of it was to do with status. I remember when I was put on the board, I got lots of congratulations messages from people all over the place, and the only person who wasn't that impressed was me. But I noticed when I went to the first board meeting that the person who took more notes than anyone else was David Ogilvy, which reminded me of how I started, that it was all about study. He was still studying, he was still learning. But eventually, of course, Martin Sorrell came along and bought the business.
Describe who he was at that time.
Well, Martin Sorrell was an accountant who had been the financial partner in Saatchi & Saatchi. Saatchi & Saatchi were two guys who built up a hugely successful agency, first of all in Britain, secondly around the world. One of them is now Lord Saatchi, and I think the other one, Charles, is not. They're very, very famous in this business. They also were very instrumental in helping Margaret Thatcher win a couple of elections. And if you were to live near where I live in Chelsea, you'd walk down the road for 15 minutes and you'd come across an enormous, beautiful building, which is the Saatchi Gallery, because Charles Saatchi has put all his money into art. He's a very famous art connoisseur.
Was Saatchi & Saatchi comparatively as big as Ogilvy & Mabe worldwide?
No, they were not, but they were the fastest growing agency. They were a phenomenon. They grew incredibly fast, and they overreached themselves. They got so pleased with themselves that at one point they made a bid for the Midland Bank, which is one of the five big banks. They were hugely ambitious. And at that point, everyone said, look, this is ridiculous, and they lost a bit of credibility. And they were actually thrown out because they're a public company. And they went away and they started again a firm called M&C Saatchi, which does extremely well. Again, a worldwide agency. They must be the only agency I can think of offhand that's got Saatchi & Saatchi and M&C Saatchi. Both very successful agencies worldwide. So they were pretty remarkable people. Well, what's happened with Martin Sorrell was that he left Saatchi & Saatchi and he bought a small company called Wire and Paper Products, which I think made supermarket trolleys. And he used this as a financial vehicle to start acquiring businesses. And after a while, he acquired J. Walter Thompson, which at that time was the third largest agency in the world. And he did it because he had noticed two things. Number one, they were not well managed financially. And number two, they had property in Tokyo, which was worth, I think, $800 million, and which on its own was able to finance the whole deal. once he bought Saatchi & Saatchi, he then looked around and wanted to buy Ogilvy & Mather. And he overpaid for Ogilvy & Mather. I remember our share price was 20-odd and he paid 54 or something, but he paid far too much. He is a very smart man. Starting from that standpoint, he built up the second largest advertising agency and communications group in the world. The only person who's done that so quickly. And I remember he was always interested, not in the very, very top people, but the people just below the top. And he went to a lot of trouble to try and find out what I wanted. And he took me out for lunch and breakfast and dinner. What do you want to do? And I didn't have any idea, because I'd done what I wanted to do in a way.
The deal had been done, so he already...
The deal had been done. I wasn't going to make any more money anyhow, because I'd sold my business to Ogilvy, so I had no real interest in Ogilvy itself, because I hadn't taken shares. He spent time trying to find out what I was doing, or wanted to do, and one day I ran into him near his office in Mayfair early in the morning, and he said, oh, he said, how are you? And I said, good morning. And he said, what are you up to? And I said, I'm going to resign. And he said, why? And I said, because I don't want to spend the rest of my life working like a dog to pay back all that money you borrowed.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I was right, but I'm definitely sure of one thing. I was very wrong about one thing. The two big mistakes I made at this point. I was approached by a very, very smart young man who took me out to dinner and said, what are you going to do now? And I said, I don't know. I'll just do a bit of consultancy. And he said, we all thought you would activate all your clones all over the world and start another business. And that's what I should have done, but I didn't. That was a huge mistake. That was a huge mistake. That was one big mistake. One big, big mistake. That young man went away. He was a chap I'd spotted as a talent. He became creative director of Ogilvy & Mather director after I left, and then he left and started his own agency and sold it for a lot of money.
You're listening to an interview on Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. You could have gone along for the ride.
He and other people expected me to take all these people.
Yeah, and start your own agency.
Yeah, apparently they all thought I was the bee's knees. And I had an opportunity which I turned down. And the second big mistake was I started my own little business, which was doing very, very well, but I wasn't really doing a tremendous amount of work. And I thought, well, I'll give the majority of the business away to other people and let them run it. They're doing most of the work. And I did this, and the name of the agency at that point was the Drayton Bird Partnership. And these people did some research, and they discovered that the thing was their business was totally associated with Drayton Bird. And so they came to the rather bizarre conclusion that it was a smart thing to do to take away the name Drayton Bird and call it the partnership. That business collapsed, and that is one of the main reasons why I still work every day at 73. The other reason being that I enjoy it. So I suppose I've come full circle, because I started out in this business thinking, wow, you know, this is a business where nobody learns. I shall learn and do well. And I've finished. I'm still there. You know, I still enjoy it. There are things like, you know, what's going on the internet. I'm constantly studying it and trying to learn more. Take what you're doing, you know. When you started interviewing me, I thought, this is really interesting. I can learn something from this.
What's Churchill's advice?
I was very inspired by this. I often repeat it. He said, courage is the ability to go from failure to failure without loss of enthusiasm.
What could you tell the students listening to this interview? What would you like them to find out about you and what you have to offer at your website? Can you give your website address and let them know what they can expect to find there in your blog?
Well, I have about 5 blasted addresses, but the one that's most entertaining is the thing that, of course, is called Drayton Bird Droppings, which is just Drayton-Bird-Droppings. It's really my blog. It's just something I write probably 3 or 4 days a week. Some of it's about things that are nothing to do with business. For instance, today I wrote about an opera singer, a ballet dancer, but also about bad design. Because after I'd watched the man who's supposed to be the world's best ballet dancer right now, I commented that you couldn't read the program because it was set in a type which was reversed out. It's impossible to read. And then I commented on the fact that most designers seem to be totally uninterested in communicating. So I write about all sorts of things there. I have another site which is called www.draytonbirdcommonsense.com. And that site is where you can go and get free ideas, which is the one thing I would recommend people get. Because what I do is I send out every 3 days a helpful marketing idea. There's 101 of them. So what people sign up for that, they get 101 helpful marketing ideas, and they can also download a copy of the best book ever written on marketing, and the shortest, which of course is Claude Hopkins' Scientific Advertising. The thing that is preoccupying me at the moment, to be absolutely honest, is the thing that I run every year. Every year I run a little business school, sometimes in London, I've run it in Brussels, and it's sort of 3 days where I spend most of the time with them. I'm there all the time, and I have the people that I respect come along and speak. For instance, I've got the vice chairman of the Ogilvy Group here in the UK is going to be the opening speaker. He's very interesting. He's spoken on TED. He's a very interesting guy. But I've got a wide range of speakers. I've got a man who makes God knows how many millions a year through affiliate marketing, and I think he's got a total staff of 3. He's an American. Then I've got one of my old clients at American Express who's been around the world and who talks about understanding customers, which is the one weak point that many people have. And the man I mentioned, the man who said, are you going to start your own business? His name is Steve Harrison. He comes along and talks. Apart from being extremely clever, he's absolutely hilarious. I don't know what he's going to say this year, but last year he started by putting up a picture of the weather forecast from a newspaper. And he said, you know, this creative business is very, very hard. The first thing you've got to realize is that the weather forecast is far more interesting than anything you're going to think of.
That's funny.
So it's people who talk about practical ways in which you can succeed. For a whole year, I do monthly webinars almost entirely myself. The idea is to give people not just one of these quick things that say, hey, just sign up for this and you'll be rich in 3 weeks. It's one of these things that says, look, you want to get rich slowly? Well, this is the way to do it, because this covers every aspect of marketing. So you really know what you're doing rather than hoping you're going to get a lucky hit. And that's really what I'm all about. I'm really all about teaching people the basis without all the bullshit and the wild claims, just saying, this is what it's like. It's good fun. If you go about it the right way, you can make a lot of money, and you'll certainly never be bored.
Would you agree the basis all comes back to the tried and true direct marketing principles that you teach about in your book and that you learned from all those?
Absolutely so. The reason I rang you a little late today was I was talking to a journalist who was asking me about a wine club that I happen to know the founder, and she'd got this theory about, you know, is it all to do with social marketing? I said, it's nothing to do with that. It's to do with it. This man understands that the important thing is to make an emotional connection with his customers. He understands the numbers. He understands that if you can keep a customer for a little bit longer, you'll make more money than your competitor. He understands that if you can get a little bit more money out of each transaction, you can make a little bit more money. Yeah, and it's a very basic thing. I've been thinking about marketing for 50-odd years now. Every year, it seems simpler to me. And I think that the aim of marketing is to help people to choose and to help people to choose you if you want to make a living. But in the end, all you're actually doing is you're bringing two things together. You're bringing that person out there who will benefit from what you offer together with what you offer. You're bringing them together. And generally, it's always done the same way. You offer something to people that appeals to them. You offer that, particularly on the internet, but generally, you're either going to give them some information or some knowledge or a benefit that appeals to them, something free that they're going to pick up. In that way, you make a connection with them. And by making a connection with them, you then have an opportunity to help them and to build a relationship with them and to turn them from being prospects into customers, from customers into friends, and then being such friends that they'll recommend their friends also to come along. Viral marketing, they call it now. There's nothing new about it. Imagine you're somebody in a canoe paddling down the middle of a river and you're standing on the bank and you want to attract him and get him to come and stop by you. That's what you're trying to do. All these people are paddling their little canoes, living their lives, doing what they want to do. You've got to attract their attention with something sufficient to make them change direction and come to you and do what you want them to do. That's what it's all about. And that's what's fun about it, is when you do get people to do what you want them to do.
All right, Drayton, I really appreciate it.
A great pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right, I appreciate it. Have a wonderful evening. For more interviews like this, go to hardtofindseminars.com.